Meanwhile, it seems like their flailing is having the exact impact that they wanted it to.
Is the other country in the region that's bombing 5-7 countries flailing recklessly as well?
Yeah, it's unclear. We're really surprised that Israel decided to bomb Lebanon when we were bombing Iran. Well, at the very least, at least the guy in charge of and there, incidentally, there's other reporting now that suggests that Witkoff and Kushner had absolutely no idea what they were negotiating with Iran, that they had no idea what the Iranians were saying to them. You'll recall about a week ago, we played a clip. I think he was on A Week from Sunday. The foreign minister of Oman was saying the Iranians made an offer that went further than any offer they've ever made before. They said they would not stockpile enriched uranium. They would enrich uranium, but they would use it. They wanted the ability, and this makes total sense for any country, they wanted the ability to control their own energy supply. Because the United States was like, we'll give you free energy. And anybody who had a father growing up knows that, you know, when they're pulling the strings, like, I guess I'm not getting allowance this week because my attitude was bad. That they want control of their own energy. And you can enrich uranium and then deplete that uranium by using it in nuclear facilities for civilian energy uses. But if you don't stockpile it, you can't build a weapon. And it appears that Witkoff and Jared Kushner had no understanding of that whatsoever. Or they didn't want to understand that. But don't worry, Witkoff has got this handled. Here he is yesterday.
So how do you see this ending, this war?
I don't know, Sarah. I know this, that President Trump is the wrong guy to go up against. That's what I know. He
high on a hill was a lonely goat herd, lay, hoodlay, hoodlay, hee-hoo. Loud was the voice of the lonely goat herd, lay, hoodlay, hoodaloo.
As far as I can tell, President Trump is still in the White House. He's not out there beating up Iran.
I'm the wrong guy to go against.
I am the wrong guy to go against. According to Axios today, Trump has said, we bombed everything there's to bomb. We ran out of targets.
Kind of bored now.
So I guess we'll wrap it up. Anybody? So
unconditionally, they surrendered.
I mean, if losing basically an extra million people because of our response to COVID was not enough of a hint, but it seems that like you actually need a functioning president to at least help guide a country. There also appears to be a wide margin of error for this country. But we're going to start to see its diminishment, over time. Later in the program, we're going to be talking to ProPublica's Joel Jacobs about just one of the implications of what Trump has done with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Before we get there, we're going to be talking to Patrick DiTilio, Claire Connor, and Ethan Wecheluk. Of the Hagerstown Rapid Response. They've been fighting a detention center in Maryland. We'll be talking to them in a moment. Just first, a couple of words from our sponsors. I am in the habit of signing up for stuff and then forgetting it, like literally almost 5 minutes later. I'm fading. I'm sundowning. I don't know what to tell you, but you don't need to be sundowning to have this happen to you because we have everybody here has that same exact problem.
I'm faded.
I mean, I've signed up for stuff that I still can't even figure out what it is. I genuinely can't figure out what it is. Like, and you get it on your credit card statement and you're like, wait, how do I even get there? But there's a way in which you can deal with all of this with just basically one click, and that's Rocket Money. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that helps you find and cancel your unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending and helps lower your bills so you can grow your savings. I want to thank Rocket Money for sponsoring today's episode. Rocket Money is super easy to use. My sister Julie had been using it for years before they came to us to become a sponsor. And she was like, this is great. It saved me a ton of cash. And it also is helping her just budget her money. But it literally allows you to cancel subscriptions with a few taps. Saves you money on day one. And money probably you've spent. I mean, we're pretty good about it at the Majority Report. We send you like a notice that something's renewing or something like that. But a lot of places don't. That's their business model. Is you and Rocket Money saves you a ton of cash in that way. You can set budgets and goals for your finances. You can get personalized insight and regular reports as to how you're spending your money and what areas. You can also receive real-time alerts for large transactions, which is important just in case somebody's out there, I don't know, has stolen your credit card or something. You can get notices about upcoming bills or refunds or low balances. It does it all for you if you're looking to try and get control of your finances. Let Rocket Money help you reach your financial goals faster. Go to rocketmoney.com/majority to join. That's rocketmoney.com/majority. rocketmoney.com/majority. We'll put the information in the YouTube and podcast descriptions. Meanwhile, also sponsoring the program today is SelectQuote. Things are a little insane right now in the world. I don't know if you picked up for that. God knows what's going to happen with this oil shock. AI is coming for jobs. Feels like, for me personally, I'm waking up every hour, every night, it seems like. I don't know why. There is one thing you can count on is that at one point, we're all going to pass away. But if you have loved ones, or if you anticipate having loved ones in your future, now is the time to get life insurance. For around the same price as one of your streaming services, you can get the right life insurance policy. And here's the key, folks, which I didn't realize until I was deep into my 30s. Maybe it was my early 40s. The younger you are, the cheaper your life insurance policy is. This is true with actually all your insurance. So the time to get it is now. Because you're going to need it later. I can tell you, I waited until I had my first kid. And then I waited for a couple of years because I'm like, oh, I'll get to it. And I was intimidated. And frankly, I'm not sure that we had services like this then where it makes it so easy. But once you get life insurance, you feel like something's been lifted off your shoulders. And like I say, you get it now when you're young. It can be like literally under $20 a month, and you've got a great life insurance policy. For over 40 years, SelectQuote has helped more than 2 million Americans understand their options and get the coverage they need. As a broker, their mission is simple, to find you the right insurance policy at the best price. SelectQuote takes the guesswork out of finding the right insurance policy. You don't have to sort through dozens of confusing options on your own, and it's intimidating. But the easier way is that when one of their licensed agents find you the right policy at the right price for you, comparing plans from trusted, top-rated insurance companies to find a policy that fits your health, your lifestyle, your budget, and they work for you for free. You're going to be covered faster than you think. SelectQuote works with providers that offer same-day coverage, up to $2 million worth with no medical exam required. And you're not out of luck if you have pre-existing health conditions, because SelectQuote partners with companies that offer policies for people with conditions like high blood pressure, diabetes, heart disease. SelectQuote makes life insurance simple. Even if this is your first time thinking about it, head to SelectQuote.com/majority right now. Check it out. You will see how easy this is. A licensed insurance agent will call you right away with the right policy for your life and your budget. Life insurance is never cheaper than it is today. Get the right life insurance for you for less. Save more than 50% at SelectQuote.com/majority. Save more than 50% on term life insurance at SelectQuote.com/majority today. To get started, that's SelectQuote.com/majority. They shop, you save. We'll put that information in the podcast and YouTube description. Quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to the Hagerstown Rapid Response Team. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Emma Vigeland out today. Joining us now, Patrick DiTillo. He is the founder of the Hagerstown Rapid Response, which is a real-time alert network for ICE sightings and community emergencies. Claire Connor, an organizer with Hagerstown Rapid Response. Ethan Wetchluck, also an organizer for the Hagerstown Rapid Response and running for Congress in Maryland's 6th District. Guys, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us. Patrick, let's start with you. When did you set up the Hagerstown Rapid Response? What was happening with ICE at that time?
Yeah, it was really as a result of what we were seeing in Minnesota. It was the end of January there. And it was really built to protect our neighbor from state terror, like we were seeing in Minnesota. We started as a signal-based alert system for ICE sightings, but we've evolved into a full-scale organizing front. We have like 500 members now in a signal chat. That's sort of where it was born out of, and it has been growing like crazy ever since.
And Claire, so at what point did this detention center sort of come on to the scene? You guys organized in prep for ICE coming. Was there, I guess I should ask first, was there an ICE surge? I mean, even in New York, we have sporadic ICE sightings, but nothing like, you know, what Minnesota saw or L.A. saw or Chicago saw. Was there anything like that? And then just tell me about the pivot to the detention center.
Sure. Well, I think that there wasn't necessarily a surge locally here in the community, but it was the news of the acquisition of a mega warehouse and the proposed retrofitting of that location into a detention center that was startling for all of us. It happened very abruptly. And it happened, just overnight almost. And the lack of answers along the way to the questions and concerns that we've voiced has further encouraged us to keep pressing and asking and trying to find out the truth.
So, Ethan, I mean, what do you know about that facility at this point? Like, who owns it? Who owns it? Where in the process of the sale is it? How far down the road have they gone?
Yes, and unfortunately, we are too far down the road for this. It is owned by DHS right now.
How long have DHS owned it? Do you know?
January.
Since January.
January 29th, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah, January 9th. And for people who are sitting there wondering, okay, well, why would the federal government purchase this? Why not have a third party and lease it? The federal government purchases and owns things. They can get away with trying to circumvent certain rules and requirements. That's the supremacy clause. I'll nerd out on the Constitution here, but it allows them to avoid zoning regulations, perhaps some building codes and permitting processes and things like that. So what you've seen is ICE has gone across the country and bought these facilities. So then the local jurisdictions can't come in and say, no, you can't do this. So that's represented a real challenge in fighting back and pushing back, because you're not just pushing back against some, you know, company. You're pushing it back against the whole, you know, entirety of the federal government.
So, Patrick, I mean, what are having been aware of fights to stop, let's say, a coal-fired power plant in a certain area or something like that, where you can say, okay, we need these, we need to use Department of the Environmental, Act to see if the permitting has been done right and this and that, that the feds buy the facility, make it easier for them to bypass it. So what do you do as an organizer to push back on that?
Great question. We dove into a lot of research around who owns what. Specifically, the biggest points that we were hammering was who owned the water and who owned the sewer. Because a warehouse with an estimated 150 staff is going to need significantly more water and sewer capabilities than a 1,500-person detention facility. So we took a look, and the county owns the sewer. So we've been pushing them and trying to contact them to find out more about our capacity, whether we can just outright stop them from accessing the sewer. And then the same sort of thing with the water, which we determined was owned by the city of Hagerstown, which is a little more on our side in this fight.
And so the idea is that we can't necessarily inhibit them from, well, they've already purchased the facility.
Right.
But we can essentially deny them infrastructure.
Exactly.
By going through entities that are still under local control. So, Claire, how do you put pressure on those local entities? And I'm also curious, I mean, just to go backwards a little bit, you've got 500 people on a signal. How does that happen?
So we, in order to put pressure on the different entities that are involved directly or possibly even indirectly, we have been having protests. That's one way to get people to rally together around this issue, to discuss their concerns. In particular, Hagerstown Rapid Response has been partnering with our local Indivisible chapter to protest each week in front of the Board of County Commissioners office building. They are a group that we have a little bit of tension with at the moment, given that very shortly after they, quote unquote, found out that the warehouse was going to happen, they endorsed its arrival with open arms and said that they were effectively complicit with whatever DHS wanted to do with it.
This is the board.
Our county commissioners, correct.
Okay.
So continuing to hold these protests to try to get their attention. They've also barred us from being able to speak in a public forum at their meetings. This has been ongoing for a while, but it's become an increasingly tense situation as this situation develops.
And how did you get the 500 people that you have access to on Signal? I imagine there's others too who have, you know, that at least are rallying around this specific issue. How did you first, like, how did you build that list?
Sure. I mean, there have been opportunities at the rallies to talk to other people and get an idea that they're like-minded and gauge whether they'd be interested in helping out, because there are many ways to help out Hagerstown Rapid Response beyond being boots on the ground or a researcher. We do things like mutual aid and also just, yeah, general social events to try to lighten the mood. So word of mouth, we, with our petitions that we've been launching, have been gauging interest in the community that way, and also reaching out to our neighboring communities, maybe in Frederick County and Montgomery County, Howard County, Allegheny, going to the west, just to try to build that support around us here.
And even, are there like legal avenues, litigation, or I imagine like there's public hearings maybe that you guys are attending when it comes to stuff like the infrastructure? So we have on one hand just sort of like public pressure in the sense that all these people are politicians and they may not want to have such a fervent group of people who might put up a different, you're running against an incumbent congressperson whose record on a whole host of things, frankly, has been rather garbage. We've spoken just the other day to Alexis Goldstein, who's also running for that in that primary. What are the different avenues that you guys are pursuing aside from like public pressure? Are there legal ones? Are there filings?
Yeah, you know, it starts with having a spine, Sam, and it sounds like one of those basic things, but you know, to put this in context, Representative April McLean Delaney, on January 22nd, when they voted on the Lake and Riley Act of 2025, 48 hours after Trump came into office, she voted to enact the Lake and Riley Act, which expanded mandatory detention. So that really set the groundwork for this, and this is the environment now that Western Maryland has inherited, right? That we have a representative, we have political leadership, not just Republicans, but Democrats, who are saying, well, maybe there's elements of this that are a good thing. So when it comes to fighting back, you know, as Patrick and Claire have mentioned, it's looking at everything. Can we attack the water? Can we attack the sewer? Can we attack the electricity? Can we attack the telecommunications, right? Is there a way to, you know, delay them being able to get internet access, to set up security cameras, right? And one of the biggest avenues, and thanks to the great work of the Attorney General here in the state of Maryland, Anthony Brown, has been to go after and look at an environmental review. So there's the NEPA, which sets environmental reviews for projects. And that part of Hagerstown and Williamsport, and it's worth mentioning, that is a historic area. I mean, Williamsport, where the warehouse is located, is an extraordinarily beautiful, historic town. Houses that go back into the 1700s. And so there's a lot of, you know, things to consider. There's also a stream that runs right by the warehouse that drains into the Potomac, major watershed. So a lot of those historic and environmental reviews were, you know, short-circuited, right? The government tried to speed through them and said, we don't gloss over this. No one's going to really pay attention. Correction, Maryland is paying attention. We pay attention to these things. Maryland is immensely proud of our history. Maryland is immensely proud of our environment. And we don't take lightly when someone else comes to, you know, tries to come in and tell us, no, we don't have to focus on that. No, we do have to focus on that. And so, the Attorney General had filed, a lawsuit based on the environmental and historic reviews. And then he's just requested, because they started construction. Contracts were awarded just in this past week, and they've already, I was out at the warehouse on Monday looking around. They're already bringing contractors on round to survey the site. They're bringing in trailer trucks for bathrooms for the construction workers, right? And they're just plowing ahead as if they're just going to get away with it. So the Attorney General have filed another lawsuit to put a pause on that. and say, you guys have to wait until the court can rule on the other case. So we're optimistic that that's going to work, and it's going to slow it down, because ICE has to realize, and DHS as a whole, that this people just don't want this. They just don't want these facilities in their backyards. They don't want these facilities in their communities. They don't want these facilities in their states. We just don't want them, period. But especially when it's in our community and destroying the very fabric of what makes us who we are.
I imagine there's also a sense that this time next year, Congress, at least the House, at the least, will have a little bit more ability to start to tighten the sort of the purse strings for these type of things. But yeah. In the meantime, Patrick, is there an attempt in the community to sort of also you're looking at infrastructure, but there's, I would imagine, the people doing the building of this outfit, they're from the community. I imagine that they do other commercial projects or residential projects. And like, is there an effort to also say, like, I remember back in the day, if you were hiring scab workers, there'd be a big fat, massive rat that people would bring out in front of the job yeah. site. I don't know if it's that, you know, something like that. But is there an effort to also say, like, hey, you guys are working on, one of the most sort of like despised projects in the country right now?
Yeah, I think we are looking at it from all angles. Every worker, every subcontractor is definitely on our radar. We're actively looking for the likely subcontracts that are going to come out from the general contractor in Gettysburg. They're not going to go unnoticed. We are actively pursuing all avenues.
Great.
Of and resistance. Yeah.
Claire, how can people get involved outside? Like, I mean, if we want to help in your efforts, or if people locally, like, I mean, how far, you know, what's the range of people you have that in terms of distance that are on your signal or just showing up for rallies?
Sure. It is actually a broader population than you might expect. In terms of Hagerstown Rapid Response, we serve the entire Washington County vicinity. We do also partner, again, with Frederick County, with Franklin County in Pennsylvania, and neighboring communities in West Virginia, because the activity in those locations is relevant here, too, and they have concerns, too. But in terms of, yeah, active sightings, we're working within the scope of our county. If people are interested in joining us, we do have a website that has launched, and it's just HagerstownRapidResponse.com. I will note that our latest petition is up on the homepage of the website, if you scroll down a little bit. And this particular petition is putting pressure on job recruitment sites like Indeed, ZipRecruiter, so on and so forth, to stop listing jobs for Department of Homeland Security and ICE in order to employ people for these detention centers in light of these job postings for the Williamsport warehouse having gone up this past weekend, I believe on Saturday.
I imagine also people, I don't know if you have to join those sites to go and apply for jobs.
It's a very good question.
I would imagine that would be like really problematic if there was a lot of people sincere about taking the job. I know when I've posted stuff and a lot of people go in there, it takes so much time and resources. Anyways, Patrick, Claire, Ethan, thanks so much for coming on. We will put a link to the Hagerstown Rapid Response site. And, I guess if folks wanted to find like where those job postings are, it wouldn't be hard to search. Like where, I mean, if I, just because I don't know how this is going to work out for me. In the event that I'm looking for a job, because I understand Maryland has like crabs and like you, there's like water around there. Yeah,
there's a whole bunch of stuff.
Right?
Well, maybe not.
If I ever wanted to move to that area and I was looking for the jobs, like where would I search for those jobs?
Yeah, I think we have a lot of really good answers to all of those questions right on HagerstownRapidResponse.com and our Signal chat, which you can join from the website itself.
I really appreciate that because,
you know, just in case.
You're welcome here anytime, Sam.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
Anytime.
I appreciate it. All right, guys, thanks so much. Really appreciate the work you're doing. Good luck. I really you guys are doing great work and really, really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break and we're going to then we'll be talking to Joel Jacobs, data reporter at ProPublica, to discuss a, you know, I mean, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau gets 86th, and it's hard to assess like the absence of something. So, I mean, this is a tiny facet of it, but it's an important one, and he'll tell us about that in a moment. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Emma Viglin is out today. Just recalling our last segment, usajobs.com. Also a place if you're looking or just even thinking about like
practice applying.
What would it be like? Yes, it's a great, it's always good to apply for a job when you don't need one. And so if you head over there and fill up people's inboxes looking for jobs, and then I can tell you it can be really confusing for people reading through those things. Anyways, want to welcome to the program Joel Jacobs. He's a data reporter at ProPublica. He has written a piece about sort of like one relatively, I mean, in terms of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's portfolio, you know, a sliver of it, but it impacts so many people and so dramatically. And it's just one example of what we've lost when we lost the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Joel Jacobs, welcome to the program. First off, broadly speaking, tell us like what's happening at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. Yeah, I mean, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, you know, technically still exists. That's partially because of a lawsuit that has stopped some of the most dramatic cuts and kind of dismantling. But it really has been, I mean, defanged. Pick your sort of description, but it is not. It's sort of a shell of a regulator at this point. You know, basically, the acting director, Russ Vogt, who's also Trump's budget director, basically took control of the agency in early February last year. Basically, almost immediately told all staff to stop most of their work, and then they tried to fire about 90% of the staff. Now, some of these cuts have been, you know, paused by a lawsuit, but basically they've been rolling back enforcement actions, and you know, people have been leaving on their own volition, and so people are, you know, basically this agency is really not doing a lot of the work that it used to do to oversee the financial sector.
There's two things that I think people should know about this. One, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, unlike the vast majority of agencies, is self-funding, and it had its funding mechanism from fees that it would collect from banks. And this was a way that was set up to inhibit Congress's ability to sort of choke it off They have done this largely, as far as I know, through RIFD, through reduction in force, claiming that they can do their job without this many employees. But Joel, just briefly, before we get into the specifics of your story, the implications of Russ Vogt, the guy who really oversaw the writing of Project 2025, the Trump's first term Office of Management and Budget Director, and now the second one, the idea that he becomes acting head, that seems to me to be indicative of just how important it was to the Republicans' plans to destroy the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
I mean, it is interesting. I mean, certainly he has made his kind of views on the agency. I mean, he has a view on the whole kind of federal bureaucracy in terms of, you know, his sort of distaste for it. But I think the CFPB, you know, is a really, really stands out as something that he, you know, that he's called out. And I think it's also, it is a little notable also that, you know, we did have a first Trump administration. There was a little turmoil at the CFPB, but eventually they did nominate a director, Kathy Kraninger, who sort of operated the agency as somewhat of a regulator. I mean, maybe, you know, a little more hands-off, but it was not this 90% cut, try to take down the agency. I mean, this is, you know, a totally different scale in terms of what we're seeing in terms of just really trying to dismantle it. And you know, this argument that, you know, it can arguably do its legally mandated job with very few people.
What is the when the agency is operating the way it should? I think the Biden administration, it was actually sort of like maybe at its peak in terms of efficacy. It's a relatively new agency that was developed during the Obama years, headed first by Elizabeth Warren before she was involved in politics back, you know, when she was leaving academia. And had been writing about bankruptcies and malfeasance by banks. And she didn't end up being the head. It was sort of an acolyte of hers, I guess maybe you could say. But what during the Biden administration, more or less, did the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau do?
Yeah, I mean they were a pretty assertive regulator in terms of their position trying to protect consumers, and I think that you know, what I was looking at with credit reporting, this was one of their real focuses, right? They were trying to pressure the credit bureaus to be more responsive to consumer concerns. I mean, I think one thing notable about credit bureaus is we don't choose credit bureaus, right? I mean, if you have a bank and a bank, you're frustrated with your bank, potentially you can move to another bank. It might be a hassle, but credit bureaus, we really don't have a choice with that. And so I think they really saw that. And that's why we have laws that give us the right to, you know, if we found an issue on our credit report, contest it. And so I think that what the Biden administration was doing, which was, you know, supervision, which is kind of regular examination through these kind of reports, pressuring the, and what my story focused on, the complaint system, telling the consumer bureaus to be more responsive to complaints. And then also eventually enforcement actions where they did take action against some of these credit bureaus to sort of try to push them to be more responsive and do the investigations that the law says that they're supposed to do. So that's kind of the different fronts that they were working in this realm with.
Let's just step back for a second and just give us a brief description of what credit bureaus are. There's Equifax, there's Experian, there's TransUnion. Those are the big ones, but I know there's like one or two other ones now. And for folks who are like in their early 20s or younger than that, maybe even through their 30s, I don't know. Like, I don't know when I became aware of them. But these are, like you say, we don't choose them. They oversee us, essentially. I mean, I don't know how else to express it. And they essentially determine our eligibility for loans, our eligibility to rent an apartment, our eligibility to buy something on layaway. I mean, a whole host of things. What else? What do they do? And who are they and what's involved with it?
Yeah, so the big three credit bureaus are Equifax, TransUnion, and Experian. And like you said, you know, they really do kind of in some ways control our financial lives without maybe us knowing a little bit. So, you know, they collect information about, you know, whatever debts and kind of obligations you might have. And they put it together in this credit report. And this credit report is offered to, you know, if you want to take out a mortgage or something like that, right, they're going to check your credit report. You know, we have a credit score that is often used to kind of measure credit worthiness. You know, that's generated from these companies based on the information they collect. So, you know, it really does have serious consequences. And so, you know, you don't pick what's on your credit report. And so, you know, you might not realize, that you have an issue with your, you know, that there is a mistake potentially even till you try to apply for something. And then, you know, it comes up and they say, you know, we're turning you down for whatever reason. And it can be really difficult to try to get those issues fixed. So that's what kind of my story focused on.
And people should also understand too, like, if you have a bad credit rating, the credit card that you may get, you may only be eligible for a credit card that, like, you have to put money up front in first, or you get a, you know, because you're deemed a higher risk, your interest rate might be double what it is another credit card. It may inhibit you if you're trying to buy a house, et cetera, et cetera. So these are really important things. And with all of the data leaks that we have, which is constant, I would say I don't go more than 2 weeks without getting a letter from my insurance company or, you know, whatever, some utility provider. A year and a half ago, we had a massive data leak. And sorry about that, but we'll offer you one free year of credit protection from, like, Experian or something like this. But meanwhile, maybe my identity has gotten stolen. Maybe somebody stole my credit card. Maybe they just made a mistake. And so it is absolutely crucial that people have the ability to contact these entities, which are, like, sort of behind this sort of, like, incredibly veiled wall, and say, hey, wait a second, you got to change this because this isn't a reflection of my actual credit, right? And what has happened since the Republicans have destroyed the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to that ability?
Right. So basically what's happened, and kind of what we looked at was data from the CFPB complaint. So, you know, a person can dispute directly with the credit bureau. But they also, a lot of people, especially when they might be frustrated with what happened from that, you know, they went directly to the credit bureau, it didn't fix their issue, then they go to the CFPB. And the CFPB, one of its legal mandates is actually to operate a complaint system. And basically what happens with that complaint system is, you know, a consumer goes to the CFPB on the website, they type in their complaint, it's forwarded over to a company, and that company then has to respond. And so
is there a certain amount of days in which they have to respond to by?
Right. So they get 60 days is the maximum amount. And, you know, they can provide different responses, that they can close it sort of with an explanation, or they can also potentially provide relief. Now, monetary relief, or kind of this, what they call non-monetary relief. And that's what the credit bureaus in theory can provide, is, you know, changing something on your credit report that may fix your issue. And really what we looked at is the CFPB posts data about, you know, how many complaints come in every month. And again, I mean, this system has been growing. It's been more popular, but the credit bureaus are far and away the most complained about entities. There were more than 4 million credit bureau complaints last year. And basically—
That's incredible.
It's a lot of complaints.
I mean, how many adults do we have in this country, right? Like, we have 330 million people or so. And I don't know, what is it, like, half of those people are above the age of 20, more, slightly more. But that's a high percentage of problems for something that's so crucial.
Right. And it could be people, you know, people may submit multiple complaints because their things don't get fixed, right? I mean, I will say the credit bureaus, what they say is there's a lot of spam complaints and we can get into that it's these third-party credit repair and they're flooding it. I mean, which, you know, some of their claims are maybe a bit overblown there. But, you know, it's a lot of complaints. And certainly a lot of people do have issues with their credit reports and they get a lot of disputes. And basically what we saw, though, is that the relief, you know, how often these companies, two of them in particular, TransUnion and Experian, had declined significantly over the past year or so. Experian was, in 2024, was giving relief to about 20% of complaints. That went to actually under 1% last year. And then TransUnion, which has actually been quite high, around 80 to 90%, where they were making some kind of change, you know, maybe it didn't exactly fix your issue, but they were doing some, in theory, some kind of change to your credit report. That dropped by about half over the summer. And so basically it seems to show that, you know, before, and this kind of reverses a trend where during the Biden administration, they were really pressuring the credit bureaus to give more substantive responses, right? To not just give a canned response, to look into this stuff maybe a little closer. And those relief rates had gone up. And now we see a little bit of a reversal here.
We don't have a sense of how many of do we have a sense of like what's inputted to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau? And then do we have a sense of how many of those get forwarded? Or do we just know that the first number and the last number, which is how many of those get resolved?
Yeah. So, I mean, so some of these complaints have narratives that are published, so you can see what people might be saying. Somebody has to opt into that. There are attachments and documentation people send that aren't included, obviously, because that's more sensitive. And the companies do have to give some response. They just may give kind of a more canned response, or if they don't make a change, they'll just kind of, they close the complaint and they say, here's why we didn't. And I will say, you know, just kind of the MO of the credit bureaus in general is sort of, they go, you complain to them, you say, you know, there's this debt that's not mine, right? And then they go and they turn around to whoever furnished, it's called a furnisher, whoever sent them that information. And they basically say, is this different than your records? And the company basically says yes, usually, or no, you know, our records are accurate, even if the customer sent documentation that's the contrary. And then, you know, they come back to the customer and say, you know, we verified that debt is yours, or we verified that's correct. And, you know, I've spoken with, you know, several folks, a couple people in my story where they send a bunch of documentation and really just got, you know, these sort of canned responses of we verified this, despite, you know, pretty clear evidence to the contrary.
Okay, wait a second. So I go to Experian and I see like, hey, wait a second. My credit rating is a 200. Why is that? That's bad. And it says, oh, because you didn't pay your rent for 3 months. And I'm like, I did pay my rent. But Experian contacts the landlord, and the landlord says, you didn't pay his rent. I don't have records for it. And then he just moved away. And I'm like, well, I moved away, but I had paid everything. But Experian says, we can't do anything about it. So then I go to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. I say, here's all my documentation. Here's my new lease. Here's my old lease. You know, here's my canceled checks, whatever. Where is the breakdown? The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau passes that on and gets no response. And where do you, as a data reporter, see, at what points along that trajectory do you see that information?
Right. So the CFPB passes it along and they kind of monitor it. I mean, not every single complaint might have a, you know, someone at the CFPB following up on it. Right. Obviously, there's so many complaints that come in. But kind of where I see the data, right, is when you went to Experian, we don't see that, you know, and that's something that's pretty notable. Right. We don't see how many people, you know, send a dispute directly to the credit bureau, what they say in return, that kind of thing. But what we can see in the data from the CFPB is how many people send a complaint, you know, some general information, you know, what state it came from, you know, what the general topic was, potentially, you know, what you wrote if you agree to include that. And then, you know, we see basically what several categories of responses, the big one being either you kind of closed it with an explanation, which, you know, you didn't do anything, or Experian didn't do anything, or you closed it with sort of a, with some kind of non-monetary relief, which we can't see exactly what that is, but, you know, that's intended to mean, you know, they have updated something on your credit report in response to your complaint.
And so all of those rates are down dramatically, according to your piece. And so what is the incentive structure here for the Experians or the TransUnions, or I should say Equifax and TransUnion? Is it just like, we don't have to hire as many customer representatives because we're not getting any pressure to fix these things. So it's much easier to go like, sorry, looks good to us. Or if we can make the time in which somebody examines this down to 1 minute, as opposed to 4 minutes, we've saved 75% on that division essentially.
Yeah. I mean, and one rare kind of peek into this, there was a House subcommittee report back a few years ago, and it kind of showed, they gave the credit bureaus gave some numbers on their employees and the number of disputes they got, and TransUnion had 171 employees in 2021, and they had 38 million line items that were disputed. And that's just direct disputes. I'm pretty sure that doesn't include complaints. So you just get a sense of like how many things these people are dealing with, and it's largely automated, you know, and so it's not, I mean, the credit bureaus will say, you know, we want everything to be accurate. But I think that, you know, you talk to a consumer advocate and they'll say, you know, we are the product, right? You know, we are not the customer here. And so, you know, we don't have a choice to go to somewhere else. And so there's a certain level of quote unquote accuracy that maybe is acceptable. And then, you know, otherwise it's extra money to spend on these disputes, right? It's extra people to hire. And this is not where they get their money from. They don't get their money from, you know, you and me, as much as they get their money from, you know, selling our data basically. And so I think that's where the incentive structure comes in. And that's why, you know, the CFPB was, you know, had brought enforcement actions right before the Trump administration to try to kind of pressure the credit bureaus to reform things. And in fact, we did find, though, while they brought two right before the Trump administration, there was one more against TransUnion that they were in settlement talks for months. They'd gotten approval to bring this enforcement actions, and the settlement talks had basically been abandoned once the new administration came in.
And lastly, we're not the client, right? So they don't feel like they have to provide us customer service, which is what the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau basically served that function. Like, we're the leverage essentially for all of the for all Americans, because you don't serve them. But on their client side, I would imagine there is a significant incentive or disincentive, depending on which perspective you look at it. But if I'm, I don't know, whatever, a landlord, or I'm a credit card company and I'm going to Equifax or Experian or TransUnion to assess somebody's credit worthiness or their credit score, there's no, like, I'm not necessarily upset if the person has a 500 credit score. I mean, maybe, you know, maybe if I'm, you know, renting out my room in my house, I'm a little bit nervous. But beyond that, it just means that I can jack up the prices here. And I know, like, I can charge a 25% interest rate on this credit card. And I know this person's not going to be able to go anywhere else and get a significantly better rate, because I can see their credit score. So lower credit scores, damages to people's credit report, is actually in everybody's best interest except for essentially American citizens.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, you do end up just a bit trapped, right? And so I think that's why, again, you know, I think that's why the CFPB, why these laws exist, to try to, you know, make sure the credit bureaus are accurate, make sure there is, you know, the incentive the disincentive is, you know, if you're not doing this, you're going to get sued potentially, right? And there, you can do a private lawsuit, right? You can sue potentially if they've ignored you and if you have an error, nobody can really replace, you know, the federal regulator that was really, you know, pushing these companies to be more responsive.
Joel Jacobs, data reporter at ProPublica. We will put a link to your piece. Really appreciate it. We're in an era where there's less and less reporting, and I really appreciate the work you're doing.
Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
All right, folks. That's it for us, at least in the free show today. But for members, it's just beginning. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. And when you do, you not only get the free show free of commercials, but you also get the fun half. And most importantly, you help this show survive and thrive. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com today. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, hot chocolate. Use the coupon code majority. You'll save 10% on coffee that, is roasted by a co-op and really takes care of its farmers, whether it's in Chiapas or in West Africa or East Africa. I think it's East Africa. Now that I think about it, Ethiopian, I'm not sure where else, but that's, it's a co-op. They got great politics and they also have great coffee and they also have the Majority Report blend. And you save 10% with the coupon code MAJORITY. It's a win, win, win. is what we call it in the business. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian media universe?
Yesterday, Left Reckoning, we had Cuba, Deep State Cuba, who appears on This Is Revolution with Jason Miles, talking about how a former Pentagon analyst looks at this sort of thing and what the view looks like from Europe, and why, for instance, Spain has been breaking with American Israel on this recent war. So check that out. Very in-depth discussion yesterday at Left Reckoning, patreon.com/Left Reckoning.
Also, I should tell you, yesterday after the show, I went on and had a talk with Wajahat Ali on his Substack. So check that out if you want. See you in the fun half.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority
Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who?
Fun.
What is up, everyone?
Fun.
Nomi Key.
You did it.
Fun.
Let's go, Brandon.
Fun.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7-8?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is this me?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
Oh, I'm going to go start off.
Who libertarians?
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less.
But let me say this.
Poop.
You call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt.
Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye. We are back, Sam Cedar. Majority Report, fun half. Emma Vigeland out today. Kowalski from Nebraska. I missed the free half of the show because I was on a phone call with analysts that I follow. We should expect massive energy disruptions for a minimum of 3 months, but likely until December. Gotta love living in historic times. Well, I mean, that was more or less what we were saying at the beginning of the show.
Small price to pay.
If the war was to end tomorrow, we would still have at least 2 months of energy disruptions. And I think it's going to go, whenever Trump says the war is over, it's going to go for at least another couple of weeks, because the Iranians are going to measure
and decide how much we are going to pay. But here is the other danger. Trump says, I have declared they have unconditionally surrendered. And Israel, of course, wants to keep going, although it's a little bit difficult, but there are more and more reports that Tel Aviv is getting hit harder now than it was at the beginning of this a week ago. So there may be, you know, Israel may also have wobbly knees, as it were. And I don't mean to articulate in that in a way that I think like they've lost their resolve. I think that's a good thing. Their resolve is bad. But the danger is the Iranians, who want to make sure that this doesn't happen again. Remember, we bombed them a year ago or so. They want to make sure this doesn't happen again, and that there's a sufficient price to be paid by the United States and the world, frankly, for attacking them. They're not going to stop. And then the question is, okay, if they don't stop, how much humiliation can someone like Donald Trump withstand, or Pete Hegseth withstand, without saying like, well, you know what we should do is actually just put, we should take over, this island off the coast of Iran, because that's where the Revolutionary Guard is based out of, and that'll show them. And that's when things start to really become a quagmire. And I suspect that's what Sarah Blumenthal was worried about when he came out of a Iran briefing, because it is quite clear to anybody outside of a very small cadre of people in the White House that they had no idea what they were doing going into this, and they have even less of an idea what to do now.
I emerged from this briefing as dissatisfied and angry, frankly, as I have from any past briefing in my 15 years in the Senate. I am left with more questions than answers, especially about the cost of the war. My questions have been unanswered, and I will demand answers, because the American people deserve to know. And I guess I am most concerned about the threat to American lives of potentially deploying our sons and daughters on the ground in Iran. We seem to be on a path toward deploying American troops on the ground in Iran to accomplish any of the potential objectives here. And there is also, as disturbingly as anything else, the specter of active Russian aid to Iran, putting in danger American lives.
Okay. I mean, literally. First off, no shit. There, I can tell you right now, there has not been one war that Russia has been involved in where we were not aiding the other side. They make movies about it.
Charlie Wilson's war
is like, it's celebrated. Of course.
But you guys party and drink scotch over it.
I mean, he's trying to do this to get attention of the American public. But anybody who ever, like anybody who's even remotely associated, anybody who has access to that meeting, who on day one wasn't like, of course, the entire world is going to be helping Iran against us. Of course they are. We have bumbling fools who led us into this war. This is a different situation than it was in Iraq, because these people knew exactly what they were doing. And I would say Dick Cheney, before he died, I have no doubt until the day he died, he said Iraq was a success. because we have what, two bases there with probably 3,000 soldiers, and then 45 minutes away in Kuwait we have another 14,000. We have what we wanted out of Iraq. He probably wanted more, but that was probably his baseline, and mission accomplished. We got that baseline. And they spent 2 years, maybe, you know, depending on how you want to calculate it, over a decade, trying to figure out how we could convince the American public to support this thing. These morons, A, didn't even try to get popular support, because B, they had absolutely, I mean, as I distinctly remember, I think it was Shinseki, General Shinseki, testifying in front of the Senate in the run-up to the Iraq War, saying this could cost a couple of $1 trillion over the course of the next decade or two. He was correct, maybe underestimated it. The others were all blinded by their ambitions as to what they had hoped to get out of it. As to, like, they all assumed it was going to be a cakewalk to go in and essentially rebuild the country. But it was easier to dislodge the leadership, for sure. These morons had no plan, and not even no plan on how to achieve an objective. They didn't even seem to have an objective. They killed everybody they wanted to kill on day one, but they also killed everybody they thought was going to replace him on day one, and didn't seem to understand what I know, just because I've done two or three interviews on it, you know, over the past 6 to 8 months, about the nature of the Iranian regime. It's unbelievable. Here's an example of somebody who's competent. Sadly, for some, I guess, he's an Iranian military official, not an American military official. I will read it because it's obviously not in English. And I will read it, but I think this gives you a pretty good sense of where we're headed. In that latest interview I did on the fifth day, I said we have passed the peak and we're heading downhill. Now is our downhill phase. You saw what happened just last night in Tel Aviv. This was a day ago. Meaning, because we hit the radars in the infrastructure today, truly Mr. Trump and Netanyahu are trapped in a slaughterhouse in the Persian Gulf. And in the coming days and weeks, much more joyful news will be delivered to the dear nation of Iran. Look, the big mistake they made was that they came and designed a short-term war, but they didn't realize this might turn into a long-term one. Even the greatest international powers, if they initially plan for a short-term war and halfway through it, it becomes a long-term war, no matter how much power they have, they will be defeated. Why? Because short-term wars have a specific design. They require limited logistics and limited preparations. A long-term war requires abundant logistics, extensive planning, and they have to anticipate many consequences. They thought the Islamic Republic would be finished in 48 hours. First, they brought one aircraft carrier. Then recently they said, for precaution, let's bring another ship, too. But now they're saying we must bring in whatever ships we have from anywhere in the world so maybe we can handle this. Take the USS Ford that has now come towards the Mediterranean. It's currently their time for leave. There are 5,000 to 6,000 personnel saying, we need to go on leave.
How do you know?
Because during their time in Venezuela, their mission there had ended. They were told, you will go for 48 hours and come back. Furthermore, these ships usually need maintenance every 6 months. They need to be resupplied with ammunition and many other things to be done. They came for 48 hours. Now, if they want to stay for long term, from the fatigue of the forces to the shortage of ammunition, they will be burdened with other problems. Secondly, they didn't think the war would become long term. They didn't think, for example, the price of oil would go from $80. It has already gone up to 110. You should expect 120 and 150 oil in the coming days. We're getting close to 150? Yes, he says. Well, what does this mean? It means the entire global economy will collapse. If the global economy collapses, then the world will the world allow Trump to continue his warmongering? Or will the countries of the region allow him to continue his warmongering? I mean, there it is. We'll be able to make an assessment as to just how much this guy just walked everybody through it a week or so from now. But when you see the International Energy Agency begging all countries to release their reserves, I don't know how long that will be, that will last. But clearly they're worried about it. When you see all these alarm bells go off, when we hear that the Iranians are putting just a few mines into the Persian Gulf. And understand, like, as far from what I've read, there's multiple levels they can take this. They can put in a few mines. They can put in a ton of mines. They can put in mines that are floating. Like, it's one thing to say, okay, I'm going to put 50 mines and I'm going to drop them with an anchor and they're going to be floating in there. And when this is over, I can go find them. It's another when you cut those chains and they just start washing around everywhere and nobody knows where they are. And like Kowalski just said, like, everybody's now preparing for oil shocks and food shocks. And Pete Hegseth is like, the Iranians are paying a price because now all of the people in the region know exactly who they are.
Very definite analysis, sir. Thank you for it.
I mean, here's the thing. These guys aren't getting invited to any birthday parties, if you know what I mean. And what do you mean? Is that a metaphor? No, actually, that's the punishment. They're no longer going to be involved in any type of social events. And in fact, that's exactly what Iran wants. Iran wants everyone to know that if you mess with us, we're willing to take down the world's economy. Because we're a fairly rich nation. We have means. As soon as everything just like flicks back on, we have means in which to make money. People with oil supplies, you know, diminished. We're not going to have trouble selling through the back door. You can talk about sanctions all you want. I mean, this is where we're at right now.
I don't know. Marco Rubio is very involved in telling me to do this.
So involved.
Marco, really?
We should call it Marco's War.
I mean, here's the thing. You know, there is supposedly like, you know, a lot of reports that Trump is spending his days doing 2 to 3 different things. One is asking people, should it be Marco or Vance?
Oh, my God.
And then the other thing, according to reports, is that he can't stop asking whether Corey Lewandowski got part of that $220 million. I mean,
that rat.
Did you see?
This is NBC News. Trump has questioned aides about Corey Lewandowski's role in DHS ad.
I swear, if he got his beak wet and didn't tell me about it.
First off, I let this jerk off bang the hottest piece of ass he's had since the last term I had.
One thing playing grab ass.
And now he's keeping money from me.
My beak's so dry, I need chapstick.
I mean, Trump told NBC News he wasn't thrilled when Noam testified. Behind the scenes, he's grown suspicious about Lewandowski's role in doling out government contracts.
Now, do you think this suspicion is a function of, like, my sense of good government feels like the radar's going off? Are we not doing things above the board? Above. He's pissed because he sees somebody else making cash. Like, listen, if there's a buck on the table, 25% go. 25 cents better be in my pocket before we even think about taking that table out.
Hey, the Don, kick it up.
It's like Tony Soprano with, what's that guy that gets out of prison and then starts?
Cifaretto?
Oh, yeah. He's like, come on. Yeah. You know how it works.
It's unbelievable.
I know another thing he's apparently involved in is the footwear of his advisors.
You guys are not wearing shoes that I like, and nobody wears nicer shoes than me. So we need uniformity. That's what we need. And here's a picture, apparently, of Marco Rubio. Is this from the New York Times?
No. I think it's the Times of England. Okay. Marco Rubio wearing oversized shoes. He's been buying $145 Florsheim dress shoes for allies. And this is one pic of Marco. You can see a giant amount of space there. But that's not it. There's another one here of a bunch of different guys in these same shoes. And you can see they're all ill-fitting. There's a... Like, it just looks nice.
I like to think that you all have huge penises, and so therefore, I'm getting you all size 13 shoes.
Was that Trump's ankle falling over the side of the shoe there?
No, because he would have ones that fit. I'm not sure. That might be. Actually, yeah, that could be Trump.
That's Kanks. That right does. There. Is that like, what Jennifer Welch calls him? Kanks.
Kanks.
Yeah, it does look like Kanks.
Unbelievable.
On the same page, Marco.
There is a good poll out today for. Sherrod Brown, that's supposedly like an internal Republican poll in Ohio, shows him up by 2 points. They're both under 50. You know, we got a ways to go here. But I think I have an idea as to why Senator John Husted, is it my pronounce his name? Husted?
I keep seeing John Houston whenever I see it.
why Senator John Husted may not be connecting with the people of Ohio. here he is. This is March 10th.
It's on some podcast. I couldn't figure out what one.
He's being interviewed on a podcast. It's always interesting to see what they put in their office just to get a sense of it.
Probably should have your phone face up in the background of your.
Well, yeah, who knows? But here he is explaining what's wrong with poor people.
And people living in poverty are just not very. They're not very experienced at navigating the real world, right? I remember talking to one young lady who said, well, I don't really know how money works at a grocery store because she grew up and has lived all of her adult life using SNAP cards to buy groceries. And so you literally have to teach people how to budget. This the buzzword today, let's face it, it's affordability, right?
Okay, so people in poverty don't know how to live in the real world. I can understand that if you grew up on SNAP benefits, you're not using cash, you're just using a card.
For food and only food.
For food and only food. Presumably, you may be able to use cash for other things if you have any. But this moron doesn't seem to understand that you've got a budget. If you're getting $100 a month in SNAP benefits, I don't think the vast majority of people, maybe the first month, for some people, I doubt it, go and spend all of their money on food in the first day and are like, okay, now what happens?
I eat like a snake.
When you have very little money, I think you learn to budget very, very well.
Yeah, you have constant anxiety about it, in fact.
You know who budgets really well? Billionaires. Oh,
yeah, you should budget like I do.
So navigating the real world, I'd like to see him change a tire, go to the urgent clinic, do anything. That
what does he think the real world is?
Hedge fund managing.
It's when donors pay for everything. Yeah.
These people have no idea how to do a leverage buyout.
You don't know what it's like to take $100,000 from Les Wexner, and then vote against the release of the Epstein files. That's navigating the real world.
It's got to learn sometime. We've had many guests on in the past who have explained, and I hope people understand this. Being rich is both, living in poverty, I should say, is both more difficult and more expensive than not.
Oh, yeah.
When you have money, you can put a down payment on something and your interest rates, your monthly rates are not as high, just as an example. When you have money, you can go and take your car in for regular maintenance so that 6-8 months down the line, a year down the line, you're not paying five times what that regular maintenance would be because of a problem you have. When you have money, you can go get regular health care and not have to wait until like, oh my God, I have diabetes or I have a bad infection or whatever it is.
I guess I have to go to the ER where they can't turn me away.
I mean, this is...
When you don't have money, you get a fee for not having enough money in your bank account.
Exactly. I mean, and then, fines and I don't have the money to pay for my parking ticket now. Well, in 5 months, it's 10 times that.
And the amount of free and comp stuff you get, the higher you go up in the income level and in professions, like, it's crazy.
Maybe it was a year or two ago, I found out that if you have enough money with a bank or like a brokerage house, and I will say I did not find this from direct. I was told about it, but did not experience this directly, that you can get loans for no money.
Well, that's why all those venture capitalists were putting all their money in Silicon Valley Bank, even though it was more prudent from the outside looking in that they would spread it around because that bank was giving them sweetheart deals.
You can get like, so if I've got, I don't know if it's like $500,000 or $1 million with, I don't know if it's with a brokerage house. I don't think it's like an E-Trade or something like that. But if it's like they'll secure for you like a mortgage. You go and buy a house for no money. So
literally easy mode.
So you're making money by owning a house in the sense that like you're getting free money. The value of money is like worst case scenario, 2 or 3%. If you just put it into some bank account. And so that's not money that you're spending. It's money that you're accruing. It's insane.
That's the real world.
That's the real world. And then this shit that I found out, and I think I sort of honestly found out about it through Instagram and then just sort of like did some noodling around. And also this came up when Tesla's stock was dropping. You have all these assets, right? Like I'm a CEO of a company. I get paid in stock options. Those stock options are valued at $10 million. You go to a bank and you say, let me borrow $4 million. And I'm going to put these stock options up as collateral. That $4 million is tax-free. You use that as your expenses down the road. And I think like maybe you get even like some tax relief for the interest. But if you have enough money and enough assets, you just keep rolling that. You just get another loan. You pay off the first loan and you take the second loan and you keep doing it. And as your stock portfolio increases, that's why he was so worried about Tesla's stock dropping below whatever it was, 250 or 200, because the bank at one point goes,
you you can't borrow against yourself.
You can't borrow, like, you don't have enough. The collateral you gave us is no longer at the proper ratio to what we've loaned you. You need to pay us back that, you know, $100 million you borrowed to buy your fur-lined sinks or whatever it is.
Your island.
Your island. Folks,
how the fuck am I even supposed to sell this property?
Folks, the number is 646-257-3920. I can see everybody figured that out by just the sound of the thing. And yes, I am taking phone calls today. And yes, you calling from a 218 area code, you are the first person on the phones for the week so far. Who is this? Where are you calling from?
Is this me?
Yes, it's you.
Oh, my God. Do I sound okay or should I change off the AirPod?
If you could change, that would be better.
Yes, one second.
Okay, sure, of course. We got nothing to do.
Sorry.
No, don't worry.
I got a...
Great, that sounds better.
Oh, I'm a Minnesota mailman calling in.
Okay, Minnesota mailman calling in from Minnesota. What should we call you? Just mailman?
You can do Gavin. That's fine.
All right, Gavin, what's on
they
your mind?
They probably ain't listening. I wasn't ready. I have to get my script out. I guess I'll start with the genocide in Gaza kind of opening the eyes to the American people, like how they, you know, view American war. Do you think this Iran thing is, or Iran thing is really waking them up? Or is it just going to be another 20 years of, you know, kind of imperialism, blah, blah, blah. We'll push it down the road, another whatever.
I mean, if I had to predict, if what happens, if what I think is going to happen happens, which is that the best case scenario is going to be that we have a downturn in our economy that pushes it into a mild recession. I think people are going to like be marginally more skeptical of these wars. I mean, look, it's already, this war is already like only have 40% approval rating. That's really low.
Lower than anything in the war on terror at any point, right?
It's lower than it was with Iraq, even like in its worst ebb. And, you know, the question is how much pain will the U.S. Feel? You know, this is putting aside, of course, all the death and destruction and the fact that we've poisoned all these Iranians. And
yeah.
And I think Iran is going to decide how much pain we feel.
I think so.
I think their agenda is to make sure that we feel enough pain that this president or some other president doesn't come up with a wacky idea of doing this again.
I kind of ask this because with all of the, well, we've lost quite a bit of the coverage with the war in Palestine or the genocide in Palestine, but this current, like, you know, current military tactics in Iran, they seem very like IDF coded. Do you think like the American people kind of realize that, like, military, like all airstrikes, like constant bombing is really Israel coded?
I mean,
is that kind of
I think it may seem that way to you because you know, we've been watching Israel do that. But America,
something of a civilian bombers ourselves.
We did some pioneering in that regard.
But at least like back in the day, they'd fund the Mujahideen or whatever. They'd fund like actual ground resistance, quote unquote. It kind of doesn't seem like they're doing that anymore. It's kind of
I don't know. Libya? I mean, Vietnam for an extended period of time. You know, the idea of air warfare, is so that the American public doesn't feel the implications of the war. The problem for the warmongers is there's only very there's only so much you can achieve by bombing people without going in. I mean, to be fair, Israel bombed the hell out of Gaza, but they also sent in troops to occupy. I mean, absolutely. To be fair. So appreciate the call.
Sure.
No sleep till while serving as Ohio Lieutenant Governor John Husted took a no-show side gig as a board member of Heartland Bank, conflicting with regulations he was supposed to be enforcing. Anyway, what's stopping the poors from getting their own no-show board member gigs in the real world?
That's a good example of how more states should be like my home state and have a state bank and not leave it to these corrupt institutions to be private.
Calling a 708 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Wow, wow, wow. 708, can you hear me all right?
Yes, you sound great. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hey there, I'm going to take you off speaker. My name's Dominic, and I'm in Brooklyn.
Dominic in Brooklyn, what's on your mind?
First time, long time, just got to get that out of the way. Thank you all so much for what you do. I wanted to talk a little bit about AI, do an author book suggestion, but I also wanted to talk a little bit about a potential kind of like cultural theme that I think people should be looking out for in the not too distant
future. All right, just tell me what you want to talk. Just talk to me about what you want to talk to me about. Don't tee it up so much.
Okay, sorry about that. So there is an author that you might want to look into. His name is Edward Tenner, and he is a historian of technology. So he has a book out recently called Smoking on the Hindenburg or something like that. And he just has really cool factual analysis of how technology has worked over time. So I think think about Matt a lot.
Okay.
When I see his books. But he also has a book called The Efficiency Paradox, What Big Data Can't Do. And he has written this in 2016. And he talks about jobs that are being predicted to be kind of like put out of work because of machine learning.
Right.
So this is like a decade before all this AI stuff. And he talks about how there are some jobs that are just kind of inherently inefficient. And in the book, he talks about teachers.
Well, I mean, maybe we'll have him on. I don't want to, go through. I don't want a spoiler alert here.
Sure. It's generally worth looking into.
Oh, we'll definitely look into it. What else you got?
Yeah. I think that essentially the kind of points that he's making talk about what could be a conservative mindset that is uncomfortable with ambiguity. So you're a lawyer, right? Like you could say like, all right, maybe one day these AI systems, they are going to be good. You know, they're not going to hallucinate facts anymore. Right. Maybe someone wants to convince you of that, but even if one day we have these systems that give you exactly what you want and they don't make things up, what would make you a good lawyer, right? Like even if those hallucinated facts aren't there anymore, that doesn't mean it's going to give you the correct argument every time to be a perfect lawyer. And so these people who are saying, oh man, this industry is going to get replaced by AI and that industry is going to get replaced by AI, they have a really simplistic concept of what the work these jobs actually are. And so my kind of theory and something for you all to look out for, I think, and maybe listeners to look out for, is people getting upset or uncomfortable that some of these jobs are they have a little bit of ambiguity.
Yeah,
they have a little
bit of
objectiveness.
I think this is a good point, and I appreciate the call. Thank you. I have to say, I'm not a lawyer. But I think it's going to be difficult to replace a lot of these jobs. But I also think that it's going to be easier to replace others. And you may have humans overseeing what AI does for some of these. We just don't know. But I think it's probably, you know, I mean, look, they'll, I think the nature of certain work is going to change without a doubt. I think AI's capacity is overstated, but I also think, like, you know, a lot of jobs are garbage. A lot of jobs suck. And, you know, data entry is a job, with all due respect, if you're a data entryist. You know, there's all sorts of things that could be replaced by machines. The bottom line is we need to have some support from our government before any of this stuff happens, in the form of not having to worry about healthcare, be reliant on our job for healthcare, be reliant on our job for things like childcare or old age care. Ginger Sasquatch, Sam, can you give my solidarity to Brian, please, as someone else who was honorably discharged but very sternly told I wasn't allowed to stay in the Army during a retention crisis? Hey. This Iran war has already has my anxiety too high. Also, Russia was supposed to take Ukraine in 4 days 4 years ago.
Right. You still did more than these two did.
I love during a retention crisis.
I also was asked to leave during a retention crisis, literally.
Charge.
That's fantastic.
Thank you for your service.
Did you?
We'll take any schmuck off the street over you.
Except you.
I hope you negotiated, like, well, it's not just I want an honorable discharge. I want a certificate that says you wanted me out during a retention crisis.
When the military looks at you as a sunk cost.
Right? It's nice that someone sobered up and said, we're not doing good money after bad here. This is fun. Occasionally, Cato has somebody who is pretty good. You know, a lot of times, like, libertarians sometimes stumble onto some stuff accidentally, like the Mercatus Institute, right, which is part of Cato, or where is that from? They were the ones who came out with that report a couple of years ago showing that single-payer health care would save Americans trillions of dollars over the course of 10 years relative to what we pay now.
Mercatus is George Mason.
George Mason. Yeah. So, I mean, out of libertarian instinct, and the libertarians are pretty good on immigration. Part of that is, I think, I'm not saying this guy is of that, but the libertarians back in the day were like, well, we don't have any regulations protecting workers, and we allow them to come into the country. We just negotiate based upon no one here is being coerced. This is a non-coerced relationship. You have no money, and we have a bunch of money, and we have the libertarians don't think that the economics in and of itself is coercive. And so, you know, if you have a lot of people who are undocumented in the country, it gives employers an opportunity to hire, you know, which is going to negotiate. And there's no legal protections for you. Now, I'm not saying that this is this Cato guy believes that. But that is sort of like the genesis of the libertarian sort of protection of immigrants. And of course, someone like Senator John Kennedy, He wants his cake and eat it too. He wants corporations to get free labor or a reduced labor costs by hiring immigrants, to the point where I'm sure this guy's in favor of, we should lower the age in which you can work. Because, and just a little dirty secret about this, it's not because there are U.S. citizens, teenagers who want the opportunity to go work in a meat processing plant. It's because it diminishes the liability of corporations hiring 15 or 16-year-olds from Guatemala working at their meat processing plant because, like, you know, we just saw the documentation. We didn't need a parental signature or anything. Of course, they can't get a parental signature. So it's just one more way in which it makes it easier for them to get cheap labor. So this guy wants both cheap labor and to demonize immigrants, Kennedy does. But he gets his ass handed to him by this guy from Cato, David Beyer. He's a good follow on the Twitter or whatever it is. Smart guy and puts out some good stuff about immigrants. And they're pissed at Cato right now because Cato is like reminding everybody like the net benefit of immigrants is it's a net benefit.
Or a free lunch almost.
Exactly.
Don't you think your hyperbolic statements undermine your credibility?
What hyperbolic statement did I make?
On February the 11th, 2026, you posted on Blueski. Quote,
Sam's
my words, or your words, not mine. The Democrats' video telling service members to ignore illegal orders didn't go far enough. They should have also urged them to refuse unethical orders, whether illegal or not. There are many things deemed legal that are still obviously unethical, and everyone should hold themselves to this higher law.
Pause it for 1 second. I'll tell you, like, this is clearly a situation, and I've got to admit, I've been in this situation where his staffer put in front of him a list of, and didn't basically go, like, didn't grade them as to, like, hyperbolic, this is the worst one, right. This is the second worst one, this is the third one. He just put them probably temporally in line. And so now he's reading something that sounds really reasonable. Like, and
so have you met a Republican staffer lately? They're all like groypers.
Exactly. And so this guy, Kennedy, is trying to attack Beyer on Blueski for posting that people should not just refuse to follow illegal orders, but unethical ones. And so he's being chastised for promoting ethics. Go ahead.
Hold themselves to this higher law, end quote. Did I read that correctly?
I believe you did. Do you disagree with it? You think people should do unethical things in their capacity?
On December the 31st of 2025, you posted to in
but,
front
but,
of...
But wait. In front do you disagree
in front
with
of,
what
let
I
Let me
said?
Finish my question.
I'm
you
sorry.
Answer, sir. Sure. In front of God and country, you said, quote, they, referring to Republicans, think they can troll their way into us accepting ethnic cleansing, end quote. Your words, not mine. Did I read that correctly?
That was in regard to a Department of Homeland Security post about advocating 100 million deportations. That is what DHS has tweeted from their own account. 100 million deportations
hurts,
would be
it?
Ethnic cleansing. You would be
Truth
removing
hurts,
one third of the country. So, yes, there
Truth
are people within the Department
like
of Homeland Security.
And you don't think this is hyperbolic? Give me 30 more seconds.
I think advocating 100 million deportations
is ethnic cleansing. On February 5th, you said the following.
Sorry, before we get to this, I just want to put this thing up because I do appreciate him drawing attention to the Nazis that were, and I'm not being hyperbolic about this, that talk about this sort of ethnic cleansing stuff. Here's DHS.gov on Twitter posting a disgusting, like, sort of aping of, I can't remember what artist this is. America after 100 million deportations. 100 million deportations. The DHS.gov account posted that because there are actual people who want to do that in the Department of Homeland
Security.
I
don't think this exchange went as Kennedy had hoped it would.
Oh, I'm having fun
here. I'm having fun here. Believe me, I'm despite all current appearances, I'm having fun. I'm glad this is going exactly like I thought it would.
Was he telling himself the truth hurts? Like, because, yeah, the truth is on Beer's side.
I'm having fun. Believe me, it may look like I'm getting my ass handed to me, but I'm having fun.
One third of the country. So, yes, there
truth
are people within the Department
like
of Homeland Security.
And you don't think this is hyperbolic? Give me 30 more seconds.
I think advocating 100 million deportations
is having fun here,
ethnic cleansing.
On February 5th, you quoted you said the following on Blusky.
Your time's up.
These are all good, but there's no enforcement mechanism. I'm sorry. Let me try a better one.
Whoopsie!
You said, quote, if you rule against Trump's population purge agenda, no hyperbole there, the nativists will name you, threaten you, and come after you. These judges are much braver than the ICE agents who hide behind masks while violating the Constitution.
They are much braver. They put their names on their rulings, and they stand behind their constitutional rulings. When I talk about population purge, I'm talking about the fact that they're trying to deport U.S.-born citizens, people born here. They are trying to deport them as well. So it's not a mass deportation agenda. It is also an agenda intended to reduce the population of the United States, including U.S.-born people.
Thank you.
These are not hyperbolic statements. I appreciate you reading my account. I appreciate
it. Here's the good news.
What planet wait a minute, Mr. Chairman. What planet did you just parachute
no,
from?
No.
Earth.
Hey guys.
You trigger my gag reflex.
So,
just like Lindsey Graham does.
Wow.
First off, like, you know that John Kennedy is losing when he does these stunts where he has to use the word hyperbole. Because the first off, the dude is like a Rhodes Scholar, right? Isn't he like a Rhodes Scholar? He went to Oxford. He went to Harvard. He is not a country bumpkin. In fact, his accent somehow has gotten more Southern in D.C. Than it did before. So when this country boy has to use the word hyperbole to make his point, you know he's already losing. And then he just couldn't even, like, he honestly, this is like, you know, when you're out game hunting and you have a shotgun and you inadvertently shoot your face off? Well, that's what it is. He just pointed his weapon right at his face and shot his own face.
The truth hurts, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Doesn't it? Truth hurts, doesn't it?
Okay. I got a gag reflex from you. You got a gag reflex because you just choked on your own shit, buddy. That's what happened right there. So good for that David Byer guy. That was extremely well done.
I like also how he kept looking around the room addressing everybody with like looks of, do you see how insane this guy is?
Yeah, that was very, very well.
And very funny for Kennedy to have to, on his third one, be like, actually, the one I started reading isn't that good of one.
Wait a second, I should have read this before I got here.
They're brainless. Like, that is a Congress.
Like,
Senator.
Is this the worst you could find from that guy?
You should have a staff that prepares him, and they're all lunatics. They don't know what they're reading when they read.
Hey, man, I got this. I got this. I don't need the yibba.
This hyperbole.
I'll just get them on the old hyperbole train. And
then I'll tell them, you make me sick.
Send them right down to Contradiction Junction.
He gets back to his office, and he's like, oh, dear, that fellow eviscerated me.
Roger, get me some tea. I need to relax after that. That didn't go as well as I had hoped. Yes. Just Earl Grey, please.
None of that PG tips.
Oh, my God.
That's for poor people.
this. What an uncouth individual, didn't you think? And next time, please, put them in order of descending horribleness, not temporally.
Tell ChatGPT to put the best ones up front, please.
My God.
And why is my cocaine so cold?
Oh, I see you've worn that ugly sweater again to work. Yeah. You know, with Donald Trump and Republicans once again attacking the Middle East with notions that this is going to be a cakewalk, and then finding out, in this instance, extremely quickly, that it's not going to be, it is making me a little sentimental. And I don't know if you remember back in the day, this was, I guess, this guy's name, I think, was Virgil Good. This was probably, this is probably 15 years old, 20 years old.
I fear that radical Muslims who want to control the Middle East and ultimately the world would love to see In God We Trust stricken from our money and replaced with In Muhammad We Trust.
That was on the floor of the U.S. Congress. Muhammad.
Why would they put Allah? Anyway, all right.
They put Muhammad We Trust, just like Jesus. We have the In Jesus We Trust, or Abraham. There was also a period during the Obama years where you saw states around the country passing laws against the imposition of Sharia law because, of course, somebody on Fox News told them that they should. There, I can tell you, someone who's lived in this country my entire life, there is no danger of being having Sharia law imposed upon us to the extent that we have had religious precepts imposed upon us. It was like places in Massachusetts where you couldn't buy a beer on a Sunday because of blue laws. Here is who is this backbencher? Oh, no, I'm sorry. He's the Speaker of the House. Talking about the danger of Sharia law coming to this country.
Look, I've spoken to those members and all members as
the reason why, and despite the fact from what you will hear on CNN that is worried about what Zohran Mamdani's wife tweeted 2 years ago, we have sitting U.S. Congress people saying that Muslims should get out of the country. I mean, probably saying worse, but that's the gist of it. Publicly. So he's responding to this, and he's trying to make people understand you need to give them grace.
Look, I've spoken to those members and all members, as I always do, about our tone and our message and what we say. There's a lot of energy in the country and a lot of popular sentiment that the demand to impose Sharia law in America is a serious problem. That's what animates this. And that's the, you know, the language that people use, it's different language than I would use, but I think that that's a serious issue. Sharia law and the imposition of Sharia law is contrary to the U.S. Constitution. Our Constitution is the greatest in the world. It's the longest surviving Constitution on the planet. And we're 250 years into this grand experiment in self-governance. And one of the principles that we believe in, stated first in the nation's birth certificate, is that all of us are created equal by God. It means every single person has inestimable dignity and value. And that we respect everyone's beliefs and their right to live out their beliefs and to speak freely about their beliefs and have that conviction. But when you impose, when you seek to come to a country and not assimilate, but to impose Sharia law is in conflict with the U.S. Constitution. That is the conflict that people are talking about. It is not about people as Muslims. It's about those who seek to impose a different belief system that is in direct conflict with the Constitution. That's where I think that comes from. Back row.
This raises a couple of questions. One, the first and most obvious one is, what the F is he talking about? There is no place in this country where people are imposing Sharia law on you. But two, it also raises the question of, like, have you noticed what's happening with Christianity? We have multiple senators on a daily basis saying that wanting to impose some form of Christian fundamentalism on us always.
Pete Hegseth is quoting scripture while taking press conferences on the war.
But he's not an outsider trying to impose a different one on us.
Oh, I see. But isn't the point the Constitution?
Well,
this is the Speaker of the House. Do you understand? As much as we talk about Donald Trump, the problem is Republicans. Republicans are insane. Now, this is not to let, you know, people like Chuck Schumer off the hook because they are failing to meet the moment, or they specifically subscribe to an agenda. In his case, you know, a willingness to do anything on behalf of Israel that interferes with pushing back on people like Mike Johnson. But Republicans, and I'm making a generalization because I can, because it's accurate. Republicans, and just every single one of them that is an elected leader of the Republican Party, and a vast majority of Republican activists, but not every single person who votes Republican, are, in other contexts, clinically insane or incredibly cynical, or their religious fundamentalism allows for them to behave in ways that we would see as being incredibly cynical or clinically insane. I think I've just covered just about all of them with those three options. And they are willing to demonize anyone they can. This is not to let other groups of people in the country off, but there is no bigger cohort of people about whom you can say what I just said and be proven accurate day after day after day. And the biggest failure of the Democratic Party is to somehow say that Donald Trump is somewhat unique. I haven't heard Donald Trump, you know, say, we've got a problem with Sharia law. Now, he probably will at one point because someone's going to tell him. But Mike Johnson is out there doing it. It's absurd. I don't know what...
Louisiana's not sending their best.
No. I may have to take a break for like 30 seconds. I know we're only 15 minutes away, but I'm a human being. Let's go to break for 1 second. All right.
Yep, there we go, folks. I was saying earlier that we have a problem with Republicans being insane.
And I actually had to chastigate Sam because how dare you?
And I am sorry about that. I know it's wrong to demonize everybody. But, you know,
because you disagree with
not
them.
All Republicans, but just all the ones who are elected to office and all the ones involved in activism and the vast majority. I will say the vast majority.
Just the ones you've met.
I've met some Republicans who are not insane, but I haven't seen them in all contexts. In Texas, John Cornyn, incumbent senator, is running against Ken Paxton, and he has a problem. And that is that, like, he's so old that the Republican Party has gotten more insane than he had basically grown up with. And there was a time where John Cornyn was, like, considered a lunatic in the Senate. I think, if I'm not mistaken, John Cornyn actually justified about 20 years ago on the floor of the Senate why people might be going after federal judges with violence. But now, just because time has caught up with him, he's become more reasonable, almost too reasonable for the Republican Party, so much so that they're going to hire somebody who is incredibly corrupt. I should elect somebody who's incredibly corrupt in Ken Paxton. Now, Donald Trump is going to weigh in with an endorsement for John Cornyn if the Senate agrees to pass a bill that would disenfranchise like 60 million women across the country. At least as a default, they could try and win their vote back. But John Cornyn has to posture as somebody who's more crazy than Ken Paxton because he's got to beat him in this primary runoff. And the way that John Cornyn has done this is by finding, at least one of the ways, is by finding a new faith advisor who is a preacher.
Baptist preacher, and
Baptist
also
preacher.
He's poaching him from Ken Paxton. It's Ken Paxton's pastor himself. So.
Yes, and so there's a lot of like horse trading going on, and this pastor had a sermon at his mega church, and I want to just say, like, Glenn Beck is going to be a little bit pissed because he sort of was the first one to do this with George Washington. But here's John Cornyn's new faith advisor leading a sermon featuring AI Charlie Kirk.
First, I want you to know I'm fine, not because my body is fine, but because my soul is secure in Christ. Death is not the end. It's a promotion. Don't waste 1 second mourning me. I knew the risks of standing up in this cultural moment, and I'd do it all over again. Second, do not let this violence divide us further. The enemy wants chaos, fear, and retaliation. Don't give it to them. Instead, double down on truth. Double down on courage. Double down on your faith and on your families. That is how you honor me. Third, remember this. America is worth it. Free speech is worth it. Fighting for the unborn, for families, for sanity in a culture gone mad, it is all worth it. So dry your tears, pick up your cross, and get back in the fight. Do it with joy, do it with strength, and never ever let evil think it won.
Oh my God! Standing applause.
Standing O for AI Charlie Kirk.
First of all, I didn't see his mouth move. Is that because we couldn't see it, or was it? Oh,
they aren't paying for that level of whatever.
It could also be image, no. But... I mean, to be fair, it also could be that once you leave your body, you have the ability to communicate. You don't need lips anymore. You just do it telekinesisly.
Right.
But I wonder, was this an AI? Like, did they say, hey, ChatGPT,
if you were doing a service in front of 5,000 people in Texas, and you were John Cornyn's new spiritual advisor after having ditched Ken Paxton, and you were Charlie Kirk, what would you say to my my flock? Or is it just some dude typing in something and using Charlie Kirk's voice?
I would think it's the latter, but I think everyone that uses AI is so lazy now that they would say, hey, can you just approximate what Charlie Kirk would say here? And I would just note that this was September 22nd, which how many days was that after Charlie Kirk was shot?
I don't know.
2 or 3 weeks after he was shot?
They were doing this, yeah. So.
Here's my question. Why'd they stop?
Yeah.
I think it might. And there might be diminishing returns. Like, we're going to hear from Charlie every
When's
week.
A hologram coming, though? That'll bump it back up.
Yeah, let's do a hologram. I mean, we saw that with George Washington, the Glenn Beck George Washington.
And Tupac.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Let's give that a standing ovation, folks.
1877, Cars for Kids. What's your opinion of left-wing anti-Zionists sarcastically referring to Christian Zionists as goy cattle and YouTubers like Tim Pool as goy slop? Some of my Marxist friends have been posting memes of American flag draped coffins and calling them dead goy boxes. I wouldn't use those terms. I really didn't have an opinion of them, but I wouldn't use those terms. But comedy is legal now, so. Call him from a 904 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hi, can you all hear me?
Yes. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Yes, hi, this is Simone from Jacksonville, Florida. Thank you for taking my call. Just wanted to shout out some decent candidates we have here in Florida for once. Oliver Larkin for District 23 in South Florida. I believe he's DSA endorsed. I'm not 100% sure. Britt Robinson.
We have
for
Oliver,
District...
I think, Larkin on a list. I think we're going to hoping to talk to him. The primary is not until August, right?
That's correct, yeah. Okay. But I also wanted to shout out Britt Robinson, who is running for District 4 here in Jacksonville. We have Angie Nixon running for Senate. And Angie Nixon, as a congresswoman, has a pretty good voting record, and she's one of the few Democrats we have in Florida that's taken that's opposed the Gaza genocide as well as ICE. So she's a pretty solid candidate. So hopefully, if people can, they might consider.
Who else is running in that primary?
So she's running against the incumbent Republican, Moody. I think she might be the only Democrat to have declared, if I'm honest. She's definitely the best Senate candidate we've had for a while, at least.
Yeah, Florida's been a little bit rough the past couple of cycles.
Yeah.
Larkin is DSA endorsed, according to Dave from Jamaica.
Good.
Like I say, we're going to try at least to have
Robinson is also a very good candidate. I specifically asked her if she supports abolishing ICE, and she said yes. Higher wages for Floridians Medicare for all, she also supports. So she and Larkin are pretty solidly lefty candidates.
Yeah, we're hoping, like I say, to have Larkin on. Maybe we'll have more, appreciate the shout out.
All right. I appreciate you taking my call. Have a good one.
Okay, bye-bye. Calling from an 817 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Oh, crap. Is this me?
Yeah. Why are people upset when I say you're on the show? Isn't that the point of calling
I'm just so shocked, Sam. I'm just shocked. And
Dealing with nerves. This is Rogue calling from Indiana.
Rogue from Indiana. You're doing great. No need to be nervous.
You've been talking about needing to get someone on for education for a while, so I have some quick education reports on some crazy stuff that is happening within conservative states in education. I emailed you guys about one a while ago. It is something called Campus Guardian Angels, where because of how police handled Uvalde, a tech company in Texas has decided to fund drones that they can set up in schools permanently to be deployed either by some button hidden somewhere in the school or to be deployed by AI video recognition software, the same video recognition software that caused a kid in Baltimore to be arrested with a chip bag that looked like a gun, quote unquote. And it also costs somewhere around like $4,000 per student per month. And so they're test running it out in Florida right now. I think the cost at just a small pilot school is like $500,000. It's insane. Just continued funneling money away from actual like education resources to put into the police military industrial complex. The other one that is in Indiana, quick story, is they have released a new graduation pipeline that tiers systems into what they called high school diploma, where you get like possible college credit, employability, where you just get set up to go into some sort of
right
paid, unpaid internship. And then the third run is military service. And the requirements on the latter are like pass an or get a certain level on ASVAB and no real core requirements, which I'm not going to say the exact city I'm in, but in the city, cities like the one I'm in, where it's, you know, old, worn down factory town that doesn't have a lot of jobs, it's setting up kids for failure who, you know, by their sophomore year, they're supposed to have made the decision on whether or not they're going to go off to college or try and find a work study in a town that doesn't have any jobs. So it's just bad stuff happening all around. There's also charter schools that are funneling money away from public right. schools and using attendance law to do it. So
it seems crazy, that kind of stuff makes me feel a little sentimental, at least the siphoning off of money for charter schools and vouchers seem make me sentimental when you talk about having drones in schools policing them. That's insane. Appreciate the call.
Yes.
Thanks.
Of course. Thank you. Bye. Right.
Hey, what happened to the PBD? I just saw somebody. We'll bring it up back tomorrow. What?
I don't know if I have that ready.
Son of a gun. Depriving me of the PBD. Colt Dog, better not read my effing IM, Sam. I highly recommend having Angie Nixon on. She's great, says Colt Dog. Tom Cotton's beard. To clarify, I thought the crusades against universities were BS. Jeter's smoke alarm raises hand. Sam, what's a goy? A goy is a term. I think that it's this. I don't know if it's disparaging. I think it is of non-Jews.
If you don't know what it is, you are it.
Yeah, that's true.
Or haven't read Philip Roth.
Yeah. should we do one more of these or should we just do one more phone call? Let's do one more phone call. Let's see. Pick a number, Brian, between 1 and 10.
6.
6 it is. Calling from a 603 area code. You are the final caller of the day. Oh, maybe you won't be.
Hey, Sam.
Oh, yeah, then you are. Well, who's this? Where are you calling from?
Jason from upstate New Hampshire, the Alabama of New England.
You know, there's a lot of places that say they're the Alabama of New England. I would argue that Brian probably thinks he comes from the Alabama of New England.
Absolutely not. I think I come from the jewel of New England.
There you go. All right. Then forget that. From the Alabama of New Hampshire. Where is that? Do you want to say or no?
Yeah, upstate. Let's leave it there.
All right. Fair enough. And what's on your mind?
Okay. I'm close enough. I could get to Canada pretty in an hour and a half.
Okay. So you're up there.
So anyways, back when there were during Biden and Republicans were talking about the debt, and you would mention Biden just or Treasury would just have to create a $1 billion or $1 trillion bill to pay the
coin,
debt.
Actually, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Is that related to – that doesn't have anything to do with reserves, the reserve currency status of the dollar, though, does it?
You mean for other countries? No.
No. So, but what would that do? I mean, sooner or later, somebody's going to start talking about austerity measures because you can't spend this kind of money. Somebody's going to have to, you know, the fiddler's going to have to get paid sometime, right?
Well, I mean, this is the argument that, I mean, and people can Google this. I think it's a platinum coin. The mint is, or is it the treasury is allowed to, constitutionally authorized to mint coins and any denomination they want. So they theoretically could mint a coin that has whatever, $1 trillion, $2 trillion, $3 trillion, $5 trillion, $10 trillion value, and then just walk it over to the other part of the office and pay what we owe to ourselves, pay ourselves off. So, you know, the argument is that it would possibly create rampant inflation. I happen to believe that if the government is not running a deficit, it's a problem because the private sector would be running a deficit, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the way that it works. So, but you could knock off a big chunk of the debt. It's an accounting, you know, it's an accounting thing. Look, you can see how easily, right, we create money. You've seen quantitative easing, right? Where we just authorize the Fed just sort of like extends credit lines and to banks and money is created. I was told the first time we did that we were going to be Weimar Republic by David Stockman. I remember being on a show with him in 2012, 2013 on Dylan Radigan's show. We're going to be Weimar.
Are you talking about the 1920s when a loaf of bread was like forever so many marks?
Well, yeah. You know, rampant inflation. So the reserve currency, there's a lot of other factors associated with it. And I have a feeling that, like, you know, us paying off our debt without really... I mean, you read into it. The platinum coin, I think it is. Is that what it is when you Google it?
Yeah.
And
$1 trillion coin.
Yeah. I mean, now it would probably need to be a little bit more. But the idea is that, like, you know, we control our own money supply. It's not like, you know, we're not Greece and reliant on the EU dollar. We have control of our own currency. Whether it remains a currency where other countries decide to store their reserves, I think is a function of a lot of other things. It's not really necessarily our debt or our lack of our debt. It is things like, this country seems unstable. We can't rely on this. Oh, wait a second. If we're doing all our business in dollars, we're going to get screwed because some lunatic is going to come in and decide overnight that he's mad about, you know, some poster he saw in Greenland, and so everybody's getting a 15% tariff. I mean, that's far more determinant, I think, of the future of the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency, frankly.
Yeah, okay. All right, thanks.
Thanks. Appreciate the call. Duber, are you saying the trillion-dollar coin would be used to buy back treasury notes? That's the paying ourselves? Yeah, I mean, first off, a huge portion of the money that we owe is to, like, the Social Security system. I'm just going to pay that back. But yes. Jay Tingle, three of your listeners are familiar with Reagan's budget director, David Stockman. Every now and then he gets trotted out, though, to say that, like, we're on the brink of, like, hyperinflation. Molly Gray, Jedi, where did all the libertarians go? That's a good question. Folks, that's it for the phone call portion of our program.
The thing that where libertarians went is that there is no one that can maintain the illusion that the government doesn't have to intervene in the economy at this point in history, unlike, you know, in 2008, where apparently people could still buy that idea. But nobody buys it now. Trump is all talking about tariffs and all the stuff he's going to do to make workers better. It's bullshit. But
I'm starting to have a theory that they only come back in the second term of a Democratic presidency. The first term, it's like people haven't had a chance to gather. It's the second term, like, where, like, you know.
I just think no one buys the free market stuff anymore. I think that's spent. People, the affordability.
You think it's never
stuff,
coming back?
I mean, unless good times come back again.
I think the likelihood of me having, you know, getting a significant amount of phone calls from a libertarian again are probably gone. I just don't think I have that many years left for it to cycle around.
It's really sad when you put it that way.
Isn't it? $18.77 cards for kids. Can non-Jews reclaim the disparaging term goyim? Somebody else said it's like, you know, like a, I think it's a Hebrew or Yiddish. I'm pretty sure it's Hebrew term. Like that would be the equivalent of gringo.
Right. I've seen Felix Biederman and Brace Belden call people that sort of thing. And I think it's funny.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it really just sort of depends on how it's used. I mean, like, you know,
I think if you say as a non-Jew that the goyim are waking up, I would, for instance, say, like, don't say that.
Well, that's because it evokes what other people have used. I mean, the best explanation for this kind of stuff I've ever heard came from Ta-Nehisi Coates when he was asked about, like, you know, black people using the N-word. And he said, like, you know, language is not a static thing. There's a relationship between words and the people saying them and the context in which they're said. In other words, like, it would be weird if I called Matt honey. But it wouldn't be weird if I called my girlfriend honey. Right? Like, it's the exact same word.
Something like language is a social tool.
It is almost as if it's, like, used to express ideas.
To people and not, like, as, like, truth in a text form.
And that's why, like, you know, I think, and particularly having come from the comedy world and been a big Lenny Bruce fan, and I imagine Brian has a similar sentiment. Philosophically and intellectually, my sense is that, like, a word means nothing except for what meaning we impart to it. So, you know, there were routines that Lenny Bruce had about the N-word where he's like, you know, we can reclaim this word if, I think at the time he did the joke, like if John F. Kennedy came out and said, I want to introduce my new cabinet secretary. He is a wonderful N-word. And N-word. And he said, Lenny Bruce's idea was that it's going to be stripped of meaning. And that it would lose its power to inflict on people. Now, he may have had a little too rosy of a perspective on where society was going. And that may or may not be a way in which to undermine the power of a word. But it's an acknowledgement that the words do have power, because otherwise you wouldn't have to undermine the power of that word. And I think there have been eras probably where, with the proper intent, the N-word, I mean, certainly from my perspective, with the proper intent, the N-word was not as bad as it was today. Or maybe it was worse, you know, 30 or 40 years ago. I mean, it really depends in the context. But there's also another good sort of like a thing to follow in that regard. And it's also like, just assess if it's causing people pain and is rude. Like, there's no great... we're not going to mourn, in my estimation, for the, like, oh, we, nobody says this word anymore. It's a real shame. You just don't hear people saying the N-word as much, and it's really changed our culture. Like, I just think that that's dumb. We've lost many words, and we've regained plenty. When I was a kid, nobody would realize that I was a Sigma Riz. It's true. I didn't even know what bussy was back then. I still don't.
Yeah.
But I like the fact that I could just say it and everybody just falls apart here and here. I don't know what's going on with that. I gotta Google this. All right, 5 IMs, we're out of here. June Oliver, Olivia Rheingold should learn to code. Block of cheese, good thing the Constitution is long, as Johnson claims, gives them plenty of paper to wipe their asses with. Kentucky boy, almost feels like Trump might have to release more Epstein files to distract from the Iran war at this point.
It's a confirmation.
It's a horrible
man. I raped a psycho. Child.
I touched all the kids. Stop looking at gas prices.
Colin from Maryland. My drone photos are used in the Project Sox Bark Box article. These are my people. Hootie and the Blowfish, the more this war goes on, the more intentionally suicidal it feels. Oligarchs, tech bros, and Zionists are accelerating the death of the American empire so as to cause chaos and consolidate power. All of these concentration camps being built are going to be put to use. I just don't think that people are that sophisticated. And the final IM of the day... California resistance, Sam. I lived in Ocean Grove, New Jersey, right next to Asbury Park, a conservative Methodist town, literally. People still cannot go to the beach till 12 noon on Sundays after church services end. Wow, that's nuts. Ryan in Minnesota says, petition for Sam to start calling Matt honey. honey. Ryan, Emma, and Abstention, great job today. See you tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the one
takes you.